next case on calendar this morning is case number 59084, Delbert Douglas v. State. Is counsel ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Please do.
Counsel for the State, Justices, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is David Rushbrook, and I represent the appellant, Delbert Douglas, on behalf of the Clark County Public Defenders. Fornication is an element of the incest statute, which means that by definition, consent is an element of the incest statute. In this case, what we have is a verdict that shouldn't be allowed to stand, and that can't stand because it's an opposite. The jury, because they were poorly instructed, because they didn't understand the consent part of fornication and the actual definition of fornication, was left to decide whether or not Mr. Douglas committed two crimes which cannot coexist. They were never intended to coexist by the legislature, and this court should rule that they cannot coexist, at least until the legislature makes some kind of a change. The origins of incest law really haven't changed. The incest law itself hasn't really changed since its origins. You can go all the way back to Hammurabi, if you like, which I did, by the way. In 1785 B.C., Hammurabi, in his original code, has 11 different definitions for incest. And this was at a time when the rape of a woman was no different than stealing cattle. Nothing really has changed. It's always been a consensual act of fornication, sex between two family members. Nothing has changed. Obviously, rape laws changed quite a bit and for the better, but it's still exactly the same. That is reflected, believe it or not, thousands of years later, in Nevada's criminal code. The incest statute is not a crime against the person. The incest statute exists in the prohibitions of crimes against moral decency and the public welfare. They were never intended by the Nevada legislature to be charged together, because what they're trying to prohibit is two entirely different acts. The incest statute is social in its nature, religious in its base, and it's not good for cases like this.
Also, as to this issue, you're talking in terms of what come for a surface, is a failure of jury instructions. And the jury instructions that were agreed to by counsel for Mr. Douglas, was this argument in fact waived because of that?
The argument wasn't waived. I saw that the state filed some supplemental authorities, which were not present in their answering brief last week. Bonacci v. State, 96 Nevada, 894, in 1980, had a conclusion that where jury instructions facially conform to the applicable law, and the appellant assented to the instruction in the trial court, there can be no plain error as to giving the instruction. The problem here is I don't believe that these jury instructions do conform to the law, because they exclude defining one of the elements of the offense.
Your point is, as I understand it, and tell me if I'm wrong, that incest and sexual assault can no more coexist than lewdness and sexual assault, because consent takes sexual assault off the table. Consent is an element of incest in your estimation. So you'd say this is a Crowley versus State kind of case where you can't have a conviction based on the same act for both incest and, which is in your estimation, consensual, and rape, which is non-consensual. Is that your argument?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is correct. They just can't coexist, and they were never really meant to coexist. The type of behavior that's trying to be excluded in the two cases is entirely different. And by the way, in case I didn't mention, I wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm not sure if I said that up front.
You didn't.
Okay, I would like to do that. So once you give me a holler over here, I'll just stop talking at 10 minutes. So the issue, yeah, that's exactly right. That is the issue. And what the state's going to argue is that consent is not an element of the crime. But we know that it is because the legislature was so specific in its choice of words. They had a million options for choosing how to describe the actual act of incest. And there's no question in this case that we've got two convictions and two sentences for what is essentially one act. Obviously, one act taking place two different times. Okay, so it's not a different act that leads to an incest conviction and to the sexual assault conviction in this case. So the legislature is choosing these words, and they didn't say in the incest statute an act of penetration between prohibited parties. They didn't say an act of sexual intercourse between prohibited parties. They chose the specific word fornication, and we have to honor that specific word. Now, the state kind of wants to have it two ways here. What the state is essentially arguing in saying that there was no error in giving the instruction is that it's okay that they didn't define fornication because it's a common term and everybody knows what it means. They know that consensual sex is what fornication is. And then on the other hand, they say consent is not an element despite the fact that the statute includes the word fornication. So which is it? What should have happened here is that the term should have been defined. If this honorable court ends up ruling that the issue was waived because defense counsel didn't object to the instruction, then I believe that, I hope that everyone remembers that during post-conviction relief, because that would obviously be an error on the part of the trial counsel that implicates the Sixth Amendment and the ineffective assistance clause.
What do you do with all the cases out there from other jurisdictions that say consent is not an element of incest? That's troubling.
Well, what I'd like to say, first of all, is that it's decided differently in different jurisdictions. I'd also like to point out my own mistake, which in their supplement, not in their answer, but in their supplement, the state pointed out for me. When I was exploring this issue, and I was looking at the Georgia case, which was specifically referenced in one of my string sites, I stated that Starnes versus State was overruled on different grounds. It was, but then in a different case, Walker, which the people at Westlaw didn't point out to me, it turns out it was overruled on these grounds, but specifically because, like Nevada, they returned to a Brockbrenner-only test in Georgia, and they threw facts out the window. I believe there were 38 cases in a footnote in the Walker decision that were overruled because of it. So what that brings us to then essentially is a Jackson issue. And I assume that the Jackson issue might be one of the reasons why an en banc argument was called today. And the only effect of Georgia changing its law on this event is that it just takes one more state off of the list of factual-based double jeopardy analysis, but it's still an incredibly long list that's in favor of it. Had this issue...
What's the majority view, not on the double jeopardy issue, but on whether or not incest requires consent as an element on a statute like ours?
Your Honor, I have not calculated the majority view in this.
Okay.
To me, the majority view is not clear. There's points on both sides. I believe that counsel for the state and counsel for the appellant both cited an equal number of cases regarding the views. And I think what it ends up coming down to is an analysis, an analysis based on double jeopardy law in part. So you do what you do in every double jeopardy case, even post Jackson. If you start with Blockburger, and then you try to analyze after that whether or not the legislature intended to have multiple punishments for the same act. In this case, because they used the word fornication, I believe that they did not. And I believe that the proper way to do this analysis is the way they do it, let me rephrase that, post-Jackson, I believe that the proper way to do this analysis is the way the Ninth Circuit did it in United States versus Rockamalam. 710 F3rd 862 at 870. What they do is a Blockburger-style analysis where they do the statutory construction test that precedes any discussion of what the legislature intended. Now, in that particular case, which involved the sale of eagle feathers, of all things, they explored the statutes, checked any of the legislative intent based on the language of the statutes, and concluded there is no indication within the text of either statute that Congress intended to authorize multiple punishments for a single sale. And the reason why this type of analysis is important in this case is because they determined that you have to have an express grant of authority for a multiple punishment for a single act. There is no express grant of authority for multiple punishment in the instant of incest and sexual assault. To the contrary, the language used says that one is consensual, one is not. They can't coexist for the same reason that murder and involuntary manslaughter can't be charged for the same act. For the same reason that sexual assault and lewdness cannot be charged as the same act.
Well, no, sexual assault and lewdness, the statutory language is expressed that the two cannot be charged.
That is true.
And so what I'm urging you to do is make the argument textually why incest requires consent. Your entire argument depends on how you define fornication, is that right?
There's only one definition of fornication. And then that's exactly right, yes. If this court finds that fornication, despite having no definition anywhere that doesn't include consent. I mean, again, I went back to Hammurabi, not as a joke. It has not changed since 1780 BC. It's always been exactly the same. It has been a social ill and not a crime against the person. And it's always been consensual. There's absolutely no law that I've found that finds that that fornication, the word fornication, is defined as anything other than a consensual act. And so, in order to find something else, we would have to essentially ignore the word fornication. And it's a word that the legislature specifically and expressly chose because it was a specific societal ill that they were trying to prevent. So, unless there's someone who can show me a dictionary or common parlance or any law that says that fornication doesn't include consent, then we have to find it that way. We can't just ignore the word the legislature used. I'll reserve the rest of my time unless there are any further questions.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, good morning.
Good morning.
Please, the Court. There are several problems with the appellant's arguments just now. And first of all, I'd like to start, I think the way to analyze this question under Jackson is not under a Ninth Circuit case, it's under Jackson. So the first question in Jackson is there an express legislative declaration that either prescribes or specifically permits multiple punishments? And here, a plain look at the statute shows there is no such legislative declaration. The second step is Blockberger. Are there elements in one statute that are not in the other statute? Incest requires a degree of consanguinity. Sexual assault does not. Therefore, under Blockberger, the dual convictions are presumed to be permitted under legislative grant of authority to the courts. So the court did not act in excess of its legislative grant of authority when it permitted dual convictions for each instance of forcible sexual intercourse.
But I think his argument is under the alternativity portion of Jackson, which is to say the two cannot coexist simultaneously because one requires consent and the other requires no consent.
Right, and that's the only place I saw for his argument is under the alternativity paragraph. However, I saw some problems with that. There are two examples given in the Jackson opinion of alternativity. The first is the Brownstein issue, where the legislature has specifically said that, has specifically prescribed dual convictions for lewdness and sexual assault. However, I think that question can be answered under the express legislative declaration under the first part, the main part of the Jackson opinion. The other one is the incidental kidnapping issue, which the court in its parenthetical described as actually a sufficiency of the evidence analysis. And I think that it's more appropriate to analyze the incidental kidnapping issue under a sufficiency of the evidence analysis because the crime of kidnapping requires restraint or movement, and so that analysis is specifically permitted by the elements of the statute. The other citation under the alternativity paragraph is a citation to a treatise that says convictions that are logically mutually exclusive should not be permitted. I would urge some caution there because that, to me at least, seems like an entryway into the chameleonic attire discussion that this court rejected in Jackson. So I think under the main part of Jackson, we don't really even get into this question.
Is consent an element of incest?
If we do, consent is not an element of incest. I'm not in the habit of providing cases from the 19th century, but I provided this People v. Barnes case from 1886.
And the reason Idaho case?
Idaho case, yes. And the reason I did that is because the criminal statute
that they analyzed is exactly, besides the penalty, verbatim to our incest statute. And they grappled with this issue of whether fornication has a voluntary component or a consent component. Okay? And I think it's worth quoting a little bit at length here. So they engaged this question, whether fornication, as known to common law, may be committed by one person without the concurrent criminality of the other party to the act. So there must be a voluntary consent of the will on the part of the one. It may not the other party to the act be the victim of force or fraud, or a child so young that the law regards her as incapable of giving consent. So how I look at that, and there are, you know, the old English dictionary, you know, the repository of the English lexicon, defines fornication as sexual intercourse between unmarried persons, period. Black's Law Dictionary says voluntary sexual intercourse between unmarried persons. So the Idaho court is saying, okay, let's assume even that it requires voluntary consent, but it requires voluntariness on the part of the defendant charged. So there is no analysis as to the victim's consent here. So you have a defendant who may be charged with the, let's say that Nevada still had the freestanding crime of fornication, and he is charged with voluntary sexual intercourse being an unmarried person. So the state would have to prove that he voluntarily had intercourse and was an unmarried person. And in fact, the addition of that voluntariness component, I hope you're following me, protects a victim, such as in this case, being charged with a freestanding crime of fornication or even incest. Because as to her, it would not be voluntary. It would only be voluntary as to the perpetrator of the fraud, or in this case, the man who raped his 13-year-old daughter, knowing that she was his daughter. So he voluntarily, with the knowledge of the consanguineous relationship, had sexual intercourse with this person who knew to be her daughter. So if there is any element of consent or voluntariness that applies only to the defendant being charged and not the victim, thus there's no logical mutual exclusivity, because in sexual assault, the consent component, we don't care, I mean, we care about, I suppose, the defendant's consent because we have to prove the willfulness component of crime. Okay, but we only care about the victim's consent when we're talking about sexual assault.
What do you make of the code placement? Mr. Westbrook argues that the fact that one is included in the statute, it's codified under public decency, and he is quoting it, and the other one is offenses against the person. And what do you make of that?
I found a very compelling argument. I think it is in the Supreme Court of West Virginia opinion that I supplied in my supplemental authorities that said the very fact, actually correct that, it was the Washington case, Supreme Court of Washington, sitting on a bomb. The fact that one crime was under the public decency section and one crime was under the crimes against a person section actually spoke to the legislature's intent that there be dual punishment. Because it intended that we're going to criminalize the act of sexually assaulting, let's say, an unknown 13-year-old girl, and we're going to authorize additional punishment because you are her father, and you sexually assaulted her. So one is a crime against that victim, and one is a crime against the morals of the state. Thus, dual punishments are specifically authorized. I remember it's the Supreme Court of Washington because they have their own kind of Blockberger plus test that they use. And so they looked at like the legislative history and things when they were analyzing whether dual punishments were specifically authorized. And so that's when they entered into this discussion about the placement in the two different sections of the code. So I think I'm done on this
unless you have any more questions. I spoke very rapidly, so I think I got a lot in a short amount of time.
I have a question. Your last theory about the two separate sections of the statutory scheme, does that still apply if, in fact, the elements of the two different statutes make it impossible to commit both acts?
Well, when you're talking about the elements, I think you're talking about the first part of the Jackson opinion and the Black River test. And under the Black River test, even if you assume that consent is required, for the dual convictions are sexual assault with a child and incest. Sexual assault with a child requires proof of age. Incest requires proof of relationship. Thus, they have different elements. Sexual assault will require, under that assumption, under Justice Sata's hypothetical, sexual assault would require proof of consent. Incest would require proof of consent, but incest would have the additional required proof of consanguinity. Thus, under Blockberger, each would require facts that the other does not include. So you could not, you don't get to sexual assault through proving incest.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'll just say the last word, and then I'll pause for questions again. A word on the remedy. I think the remedy here, if this court were to find that the convictions for incest were infirm, is not reversal of the entire judgment and all of the convictions, but just the reversal of the incest counts.
I have a question for you. It's a follow-up to the one that Justice Douglas asked about the jury instructions, and what do you make of the fact that there was no objection to the incest instruction as not stating affirmatively that consent was required? How does that factor into what's legally before us?
I think that plain error as to jury instructions, when they facially conform to the law, pose a very problematic issue when you're talking about plain error. Because especially in the context of jury instructions, the parties have perhaps motives not to request instructions on certain things, not to request clarifying instructions because they don't want an issue clarified, they don't want to instruct on lesser includeds because they don't want to admit any guilt as to lesser includeds. So I think as long as the instruction facially complies with the law, and that's what the Bernacchi case says, it's very difficult to find plain error, especially in the context of jury error instruction, as opposed to other plain errors.
Prosecutorial consent as an element, is it ineffective assistance of counsel that the defense attorney blew it by not putting consent in the jury instruction?
Well, then, of course, you'd have to address the prejudice prong. Would the jury have convicted this defendant under these facts if they were instructed as to consent? The evidence at trial quite clearly showed through the victim's testimony that there was no consent.
Mm-hmm. Anything further?
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Westbrook, coming up, I'm interested in that last story on the remedy part of it. If we agree with you, why couldn't we just vacate the incest conviction and the other charges stand?
Okay. Your Honor, you could.
Okay.
You could. That's one thing to do. The reason why we said there should be a new trial is because once the jury starts considering the issue of consent for one crime and lack of consent for the other, it might have changed their entire deliberation. They should have been properly instructed, and I think it's very difficult and very dangerous to start guessing what a jury would have done if they would have been instructed properly. I think you could send it back and do it over again when you have such a profound problem with the instruction. And in this case, you have a profound problem with the instruction. But one option for this court is to simply vacate the incest charges. That's certainly an option. It's not the option we hope you choose. We hope you send it back for a new trial, because we believe that the Sixth Amendment and the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process require that, given the specific problem with the instructions and the fact that you have essentially two statutes that can't coexist for the same act.
Well, one thing I'd like to ask is your point on what Mr. McDonald said on the issue of the strategy of the trial attorney. And we know on all this is either judges or attorneys dealt with that. We had strategy that there's Monday morning quarterbacking after the trial is over, but maybe the attorney thought about it and do this deliberately and it wasn't an accident. What's your thoughts on that?
In all candor, Your Honor, I think that zero thought went into this.
Okay.
I think it's reflected by the record. I don't think the trial attorney considered this issue. I don't think the trial attorney, if I recall the record correctly, and I hope I'm not misstating it, even submitted Crawford instructions in this case. So I think that when this comes up on PCR, and if the court rules in our favor but only vacates the incest charges, I suspect there would be a PCR action afterwards. I just hope that it's remembered. And if it comes up because of that case and because of the case cited about plain error when they've agreed to the instructions, I mean, if that's the basis for the decision, I hope that that is recalled on PCR because it would be a Sixth Amendment level error on behalf of the trial attorneys in this case. The state is really correct. I wholeheartedly agree about one thing, and that's that incest could be an enhancement in Nevada. The legislature could absolutely make incest an enhancement. If the idea here is that it's needed for some reason, I'm not sure that any type of punishment would take somebody capable of incest and make them think twice about it. But if the idea here that the legislature had is, we really need to put an enhancement in the statute in order to make incest an additional crime. Now, recall, we are already up to 35 years to life for most types of sexual assault with a minor. 35 to life is a greater penalty than most murders. I don't know the necessity for doing this, for adding more enhancements, but if the legislature wanted to do that, they absolutely could. And the way they would do that is the way they do it with every crime against the person. When they want to enhance something, they write it into the statute. They haven't done that in this case. And they haven't done it because they haven't intended to do it. That's why they use the term fornication and not penetration, no matter how slight. That is the difference between the statutes. They're intended to be kept separate. The reason why the state uses this, and it's a strategy decision that the state has, in cases of where you have a crime as charged in this case, the reason why they submit incest as well is a fallback position. In case they're shaky on the concept of consent, they figure if we can't prove that it was a sexual assault against the will of the named victim, the fallback position at least is that it was incest because of their relationship and because of consent. And then the reason they don't charge both parties in it is that because probably they believe in a John and Mackenzie Phillips idea that there's a more culpable party and a less culpable party. So even if it doesn't arise to a situation where you have a lack of consent under the law, you still have more culpable and less culpable, which allows the prosecutors to use prosecutorial discretion. In this case, incest was the fallback position. And that's all it was. It should have been an alternative charge, and that's the appropriate way to do it. These things cannot coexist for the reasons already expressed. This is in line with the Jackson case, as far as that analysis goes, and I urge you to make that finding that incest and sexual assault cannot be, you cannot have convictions for those under those two statutes for the same act.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your briefs and argument, counsel. They're excellent. We'll stand in recess until the next call of the court.